Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of The Unbelievers. My name is Cams, the Unbeliever, and I'm here with...
Badge, also an Unbeliever. Unbelievably.
Excellent. And how are you this evening, Barge?
Yeah, all right. I mean, I got a kind of mountain to climb, but I'm all right.
A three-book mountain, you mean, in one volume?
Well, even this little two-chapter kind of section, yeah.
Right. Yeah, so we're covering chapters 6 and 7, and before we go any further, I'm just going to make the listeners aware that there is a scene of violation in one of these chapters. So if that's something that you would rather not listen to, then you can look away now and come back for the next one. But if you're reading along, you're going to have to kind of get to it anyway. So, you know, it might be interesting to hear what our take is on it. So stick around. I just thought I would let you know that there is a scene in it that's potentially triggering. So look out for that at the end of chapter 7.
It's certainly shocking.
It is quite shocking, yeah.
As a newbie to the whole thing, totally. Kind of rocked me in my perception of TC, but we'll come to that.
We will, So before we get to that, we start out where we left off at the end of chapter 5 in Mythyl Stonedown with Ati Aran and Trell. Lena's mother and father, and dusk is deepening over the valley.
Yeah, so it's just a nice kind of image, I think, you know. The father is seen, you know, this big guy who works with stone, almost like a magician, and he's singing, or, you know, this incantation. And it is, does seem to be magic, because various things happen. I really liked the pace of conversation and the way they talk and address each other. I mean, it's very measured.
Yeah, there's at the beginning when we're introduced to Ati Aran, she's referred to as Ati Aran, my mother, and I thought, is this just exposition? But it's actually not. They talk that way all the time. So Trell's known as... he's just Trell, I think. But Ati Aran is known as Trellmate.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah, they refer to each other quite formally, even within the family setting.
Right, and also, I mean, the way in which the father-daughter conversation takes place in terms of light admonishment or kind of, you know, indulgence. It's also along those lines. I mean, it's almost, I mean, I had that impression later on that it's, you know, I don't know, kind of the interaction that takes place maybe in between kings and queens in fairy tales, that kind of speech. Anyway.
Yeah, there's a nice moment where I think Trell's washing the dishes and Lena wants to go off to the gathering, the circle of elders, and the mother's like, you know, you can almost imagine her wagging her finger, and Trell's like, yeah, on you go, and she runs up to him and gives him a big hug.
Because the bowl had been broken. And that was an interesting thing, actually, and I mean, it kind of adds to the impression that this is a place of healing and things being kind of put together, huh? How he takes it, the father takes it upon himself to fix this stone bowl that had been dropped when Lena hears the terrible message that TC had brought, kind of thing, I think. And then he fixes it. He heals the bowl, but it takes a lot out of him. He says he can't do this every day.
Yeah, he does. It's when TC announces the return of the Grey Slayer, and she drops the bowl. And it reminds me of, there's a, if you'd call it a philosophy or a sort of Eastern idea of, I think it's called Ikigai, which is where you repair things rather than discard them. And where pottery and stoneware is concerned, you repair it with gold. So you melt the gold and put it into the cracks and put it all back together again. And the idea is that you create something even more beautiful than it was originally by repairing it in such a way.
There's a nice metaphor buried in that. Indeed.
But when Trail fixes the bowl, there are no visible cracks or anything. It's all whole.
Yeah. There's also a little bit where he's asked, Thomas Covenant is asked by Trell whether he has another name. And that's when he comes out with it.
He calls himself the Unbeliever.
That's it.
Yeah.
Thomas Covenant, he said, as if he were rising to a challenge, the Unbeliever.
Aye.
So, yeah, there it is. Right, so he's in this place, he's kind of being made welcome. He's getting a lot of attention from Lena. And the mother then begins to kind of ask him some questions. So she begins to kind of home in and zoom in on like the reason for his presence, right? Because she has some kind of foreboding or some kind of sense, because she says that his need needs to be attended to. You seem to bear a need that should not wait.
She gets a sense of that just from his presence. Yeah, which is actually true. He has the need to deliver his message.
Right. And, I mean, he's still kind of floating through this space where he's back and forth. I mean, although that comes in a little bit more later, between, you know, am I in a dream and, you know, getting through that. But here he seems to be kind of all right, until he has this conversation with the mother, right? And she begins to give him some sense that she knows a little bit more about what's happening to him than he knows himself.
Yeah, she looks at his hands. She asks to see his hands. And Covenant remembers Lena's initial reaction. He holds up his right hand. And Atiaran is shocked. And she talks of Beric Halfhand, Earth Friend, Hearth Hugh, and Lord Fatherer. The legend is that he will return to the land when there is need. Do you know these things? And Covenant replies gruffly, no. And then she asks to look at his other hand. And that's when she sees the ring.
Yeah.
So this is quite an important scene. And he remembers his wedding. He thinks of Joan. He thinks of the beggar who told him to be true. And then he announces that it's white gold. And Atiaran reacts very strongly to that. And she's the only one in the village who has knowledge of the white gold. And he says, what's the matter with you? It's only a ring. But she says it's white gold. As forlorn as if she had just suffered a bereavement. And then she sings him the song.
Yeah.
About the white, wild, magic gold is a paradox.
Yeah.
And then we have line after line of paradox.
Well, that seems to be the thing which also... so it's not at all clear, like, you know, I mean... that it's going to go one way or the other. Everything seems to be possible, and therein maybe lies the danger that it's so unstable, and it could just go one way or the other to either extreme.
Yeah. That something that comes from elsewhere, outside of the land, it's been brought in.
Yeah, and it's this white gold, because white gold has never been found in the land.
That's right. And he remembers back to what Lord Fowle said to him. Wild magic, you will never know what it is.
Yeah. And, so he's getting a sense that there's a lot of stuff going on, and he's got some connection with it. He still hasn't heard the legend of Beric Halfhand, but clearly, he's getting attention from the residents of this land as if he were Beric Halfhand.
Yeah, and there's
or
a scene
something along those lines.
There's a scene on, for me, page 66, where he gets a feeling of his own importance when he's having a discussion with Lena, and she says, "I must not fail to offer you refreshment while you wash or bathe." And then it says that people like Trell and Lena were prepared to take him as seriously as he wanted. All he had to do was keep moving, follow the path of his dream to Revelstone, whatever that was. He felt giddy at the prospect. On the impetus of the moment, he determined to participate in his own importance, enjoy it while it lasted.
Right.
So remember that he's come from however long it was, a year or longer of suffering, of surviving, of having to live according to a strict regime, of being shunned, of not even being able to go into his own village without people running away from him and pointing at him. And all of a sudden, he's now someone.
Right.
And it says, to cover his rush of new emotions, he told Lena that he would like to wash. So he's trying to just understand, and I think he's beginning to enjoy this feeling of importance that's not been in his life for such a long time. He's had no human connection for such a long time.
Right.
And now he's in the village, and he's been treated reverently.
Yeah. However, I mean, there's always the presence of this other side to it,
yeah,
which never goes away. So the mother goes off to sing to the gathering, right? Is that about the stage where we're at?
No, they have dinner first. They have a meal
together. Right.
And he enjoys the food. They all sit together around the table with the room being lit by the gravelling, which doesn't flicker. It's solid light coming from the gravelling, which is, I imagine it to be like round stone pellets inside these receptacles. And there's a scene where we get an idea of how he's beginning to love the land, where it starts with something in his expression made Covenant feel that he came from a very poor world, where no one knew or cared about healing stoneware pots. He tried to tell himself that he was dreaming, but he did not want to listen.
Yeah, certainly getting a sense that this is a place where healing is possible.
Mm.
And that contrasts greatly with the other life, where he had to accept that hope was an illusion.
Yeah, and he's getting to enjoy status, he's getting to enjoy respect, human connection, and a meal, a bountiful meal, with cold salt beef covered in steaming gravy, wild rice, dried apples, brown bread and cheese, and spring wine. So they make it sound very appetising. And interestingly, it's all food that we have in our world as well, apart perhaps from the spring wine and the Alliantha, of course.
Also, there was a description of the moon rising later on, which made me think that that sounds like it's in this world as well.
Yeah. But there's a portent of doom to come when they're sitting at the meal. They ate slowly and a pall hung over them. They dined as deliberately as if this meal marked the end of all their happiness together. That's quite foreboding. And there's a scene where the parents, Lena's parents, tell her that she was born in evil times. So they know that this is a crossroads of some sort. Whether he saves the earth or damns it, as it says in the Paradox song. Yeah, he will save or damn the earth because he is mad and sane. So something's about to change. And then we get a discussion of the difference between the stone lore and the wood lore. So those who are involved in the wood lore, the Lily Anril, they live in a wood helven called Soaring Wood Helven. And Trell and Atiarin live in a stone down. And it says that they do trade with one another, but they don't trade wood or stone. So there's no wood in Mythal Stone Down, and Covenant comments on that.
Yep.
And that's when he gets an explanation of the stone down and the wood helven. And it mentions the Oath of Peace during that discussion. But it doesn't explain what it is. And then it talks of the exile of the people. So yeah, that got me wondering. I'd forgotten about that, and I'm curious about where they went. So after the ritual of desecration, in the period which they call the desolation, they were exiled and didn't return for many years. And that was when they lost the wood lore. And I guess the wood helven inhabitants lost the stone lore. So in a sense, they became divided in some way. And it doesn't say really how long they were away, but I imagine it was a long, long time for that to have happened.
Hmm.
Okay, and that's when Atiarin goes off to sing.
Right, yeah. And basically to tell of the legend of Mr. Halfhand.
Yes. And it's another typical Thomas Covenant info dump. We've got page after page of some history of the land.
But, I mean, in general terms, it's talking about an almost mythological time where there was unity, and that unity then split. And the description of the split is the king who becomes corrupted by the lust for power.
Yeah, and it says that that corruption comes in the form of a cloud.
Didn't that come later and shift the balance of the battle?
Yeah, it does. It does. As the battle raged, a shadow, a grey cloud from the east fell over the hosts.
And it turned his sword.
Mm.
So it made a difference. But the king had already somehow succumbed to whatever, that corruption. Right, the lust for power and control and things. And then after the coming of the cloud, then even those that had resisted before became corrupted.
Yeah, yeah. Until only Beric is left.
Yeah. So he was a formidable person in this mythological time. Strength to take on any king, and, you know, stood with the queen who wanted peace and love, basically.
Yeah. It says here, after a time, a shadow came over the heart of the king. He tasted the power of life and death over those who served him and learned to desire it.
That's it.
So it's a shadow, it's not a cloud.
Oh, I see, that's what you mean. Right.
Yeah.
Because for me, the cloud is the same cloud, perhaps, as the cloud that was seen by Lena on Kevin's watch.
Yeah.
And there's a reference later on, I think, to a cloud. So, yeah, right, right.
Yeah. And before that, before the king has the shadow over his heart, we get some other races introduced. So it mentions the old lords, which we've learned of before. It mentions the giants again. That's the second time we've heard of the giants. There's the Oath of Peace is mentioned again before the desolation. And then it mentions the Viles who sired the Demondim.
Oh, yeah. Who at that time, though, in this mythological past, were good guys and, you know, made nice kind of stuff out of metal.
They were a high and lofty race. And the Cave Whites, it's the Cave Whites who were the metal workers.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Okay. So, I don't know, I did check this to make sure I wasn't speaking out of turn, but Drool Rockworm is a Cave White. And he is referred to as a Cave White in the earlier chapters, so I wanted to make sure that I wasn't giving something away. So I checked, and it is referred. He's referred to as a Cave White.
Okay.
He's the one that calls covenant with the staff.
Sounds relevant, yeah.
Just to get an idea of the different races of inhabitants in the land.
Right, and also the sense of the time. Because this was the time of the king and queen or whatever was before even the old lords.
Yes.
So that's when he goes back to, huh? So the earliest of times or the earliest of whatever recorded history.
It's like, you know, peace throughout the land. It's that old kind of trope. And then something happens and it all gets destroyed. We start again, right. But with everyone divided into different factions.
If you've come across Campbell and the Power of Myth, Joseph Campbell and the Power of Myth. He talks exactly about that. And the hero's journey,
exactly.
Which is a fundamental thing, right?
Yeah,
right.
You're absolutely right.
But interestingly enough, I mean, I don't know, I was thinking about this and, the going away perhaps and the exile is in not necessarily just a physical one, but one of, you know, different dimensions over here. Who knows?
Yeah.
Anyway, but I mean, there are those kind of patterns and you know, he's certainly drawing on, well, and that's genuine. I mean, all peoples draw on mythology.
Yeah.
Or folklore, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. So this guy from antiquity then, and these people think he's come back or, there are signs that maybe he has, but,
Well, yeah, there are two things. There's the fact of his having lost two fingers. And there's the white gold. So to have one thing come true would be a sign, but to have two, you know, it seems if you're an inhabitant of the land, then, you know, how else are you going to think of it?
And from TC's point of view, with his growing understanding of maybe a little bit of what the hell may be going on, there's also then the memory of what Lord Bane said to him.
Lord Fowl.
Lord Fowl, yeah, goodness. Yeah. Yeah, man. I mean, I'm not quite sure what a Bane is, you see, so, yeah. Anyway, so.
It's like, you know, Clover the Basset Hound is the bane of my life because I always have to clean the kitchen up every morning.
Oh, is it used in that sense?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
I see. All right, okay. Okay.
So, we don't know. Okay. I suppose it's referring to TC as being Lord Fowl's bane.
Right. Okay, I get you. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Cool. Rightio.
Just sorry to get a wee reference to Clover the Basset Hound in there.
But then she's not, huh?
She's adorable.
Yeah, right.
We met another two Bassets today when we were out on the sports field. And the woman was like, oh, how long have you lived here? I said, oh, I don't know, 15 years. She said, I've never seen you. I'd never seen her either. So we had we had a wee Basset party this afternoon.
It was fun. I mean, ships in the night for 15 years and then boom. Okay, right, cool.
There's a wee bit I want to refer to here, just on the last page of chapter 7, when Berek stood upon the rock and beheld his enemies close upon him. He took the pledge, sealing it with the blood of his riven hand. The earth replied with thunder. From the heights of the mountain came great stone fire lions, devouring everything in their path. The king and all his host were laid waste, and Berek stood above the rampage on his boulder like a tall ship in the sea. So it's at the moment where there's no chance he can win, and then he calls these lions down by pledging an oath to the land.
Yeah, so this is then at the point where the dark cloud has come, changed the course of the battle, and he's had to flee, and then he kind of gives up, and then the rock says, and I really like what the rock says, actually, because the rock says, yeah, you can find a friend. And he says, well, who are you guys? Aren't my friends, because these guys are still pursuing me, and the rocks aren't caving in on them, kind of thing. And then the rock says, hang on, they're also living beings. They have entitlement to walk the earth.
Yeah.
I mean, fair enough. Like, you know, that's preserving the neutrality, right? I like that. Anyway, but you can still find your friend if you pledge whatever it is, your oath to the healing of something, right? So he has to pledge himself completely to the healing of something.
Yes, yeah, there is a friend for you in the earth if you will pledge your soul to its healing.
Right, there you go, right.
So to healing the land, the earth. Or does it pledge the soul to your soul's healing or to the earth's healing?
Well,
it's not clear.
Yeah, and right, and we'll see just how kind of true he might have been to anything like that, huh? So I mean, it's not clear, of course, whether he actually is a half hand. I mean,
no.
there's a lot of indication that maybe and this and that, and. The thing is that, from what the mother says, sorry, I forget her name.
Atiaran.
So it seems as if the person with the hand and the white gold might be the very last. So the last of all the resistance against what's coming, right? And therefore his presence is so alarming.
Yeah, but
even if there's the ambiguity of you know, where it could go, like the paradox.
When the bowl gets dropped, when Lena drops the bowl, it's because Covenant's just dropped the news that the Grey Slayer has returned. So up until that point,
the land wasn't
under any threat, or at least they didn't know.
Yeah, okay.
So, what are they looking for a redeemer for?
Right, okay, so I'm understanding the hierarchy of events then a bit better. So, it's the appearance of the grey cloud that is the loudest kind of alarm bell. But then, there is something about Berek Halfhand appearing at the very end. Maybe I'm just misremembering. Okay. And then, along with this grey cloud, then there's also the possibility of Berek Halfhand himself having reappeared, with the possibility of winning, or at least repelling the danger.
I think that the coming of Beric Halfhand signals that there is a danger, that the land is under threat, and they didn't know that before. So they see him. That's why he's a paradox. Because
yeah, right.
He can save or he can damn the earth. Because before he arrived, they were just getting on with their lives without any awareness of danger. And when he appears, it's like, uh-oh. If he's going to be a redeemer, there must be something coming that we'll need redemption from. And then, like Beric, you know, it was right at the last minute that he made his oath and was able to defeat the host.
Yeah.
So that's why when they're having their meal, it says that they felt that it was the last moment of all their happiness together. Because now covenants come, it's like this signifies something serious. And earlier on they said, "Alas, Lena, my daughter, you were born into an evil time, and there will be no peace or comfort for you when the battle comes." Ah, Lena, Lena. So it's a very informative chapter. It gives us a lot of information and things to think about. And not just us, it gives Covenant a lot of things to think about as well. And he does, he thinks about them and he gets a bit freaked out. That's when we get into chapter 7. And he feels the need to escape. It's all been too much for him. And Lena, she's perceptive. She gets an idea of what's going through his mind, and she doesn't give him any platitudes. She sees the state that he's in and she says, "I know a place I could take you where you could be alone." And they head off together.
Yeah, he's really kind of at this point saying, I hate to be put in this situation where I'm expected to be this redeemer, this saviour type guy. I can't do it. I'm a leper. I'm an outcast. Like, what the hell's going on? So, I mean, he's kind of freaking out at the notion of, I don't know, the responsibility for saving the world. So he just wants a bit of, yeah, he wants to go and spend some time by himself. But Lena says she can find him somewhere where he can be by himself. And it seems quite a long way for them to go, but they do.
Yeah.
She's been, so in my opinion, she's never very clearly in any way led him on.
No.
There've been a couple of times where, you know, like, he's caught her eye and then, you know, looked away in embarrassment, and it seemed to him as if, you know, and then there's the respect and the curiosity about him, you know, this innocent, open curiosity to wanting to know about him and looking up to him and all these new feelings and right. So he's, and then he's really agitated, and he's over there, and they have a little interaction. That's right. He gets to the stage where he's wondering about whether he's in a dream, and he states that this is a nightmare. Am I going too far ahead?
No, I'd like to come back to near the beginning of the chapter when he tells Lena that he can't go on. What's happening to me? And she asks if he's well, and he lashes out. He says, "No, I'm not well. Nothing's well." And that's when he mentions his divorce.
Oh, yes.
He's nothing's been well since I was divorced. And then he glared at her, defying her to ask what a divorce was. And later on, she asks him, he says, "Okay, ask me," because she's got questions and she's let him know that she's curious about him. And he says, "Ask me." And she says, "Are you married?" And that's the first question she asks him. And he doesn't take that well.
Yeah.
So I guess she doesn't know what divorce means. And we do get an explanation of what marriage, the marriage ritual in the Stone Down. Right. Lena discusses that there's a boy in the village that has been making a play at her, trying to woo her. Treok, his name is. And she's not sure. She's kind of, you know, I don't know if I want to marry this guy. And then Covenant asks what the marriage ritual's like in the Stone Down, and she recites it all word for word, all the vows that are said and what it means.
I mean, she says she doesn't want to marry this guy because she's got, I don't know, a big ambition. She wants to go to the lore university and basically go through it, whatever it takes, and become a lord. His world is too kind of small. And even here, you see, there's again that ambiguity that, you know, I don't know, is she saying this with any meaning, right? Is she saying it pointedly? And I think she's not. She's very clearly not. It's a statement in response to what the conversation is, right?
Yeah. You mean she's not letting them know that she's available?
Exactly, right. Yeah. But, I mean, yeah, so what's going on in Thomas Covenant's head at this moment? And, you know, like, you know, what kind of things is he anyway? I'm just kind of trying to picture the development of his psychological state, right? Because, what happens next, I didn't expect.
Yeah, and I mean, knowing what's coming, it means that I was able to read the preceding chapters with that in mind, and it's telegraphed quite strongly throughout the first few chapters when you know what's coming. So, Mythil Stone Down, the chapter, when it discusses the way the soft fabric of her shift hung on her breasts and hips, her slim waist, the sight of her made the tingling in his palms grow stronger.
So that's what I picked up as infatuation.
Yeah.
And, you know, so far what we can understand about Thomas Covenant is that he's sensitive.
True, yeah. That's a fair point.
He's sensitive.
Yeah.
And he's not, although there's that anger that's present, he has a lot of willpower, a lot of self-discipline. I mean, to do his exercises, to have gone at it for so long. Clearly he's aware of her in a sexual way, and he maybe can't express that to himself. He feels from him, his side chemistry, and you're right. I mean, it's there right throughout. You see it.
Yeah.
And it's never clear that she sees anything of that in the same way that he does, and it's never clear that she responds in a similar way. Right? Everything is kind of very vague and just wishful thinking.
Yeah.
In a sense, if two and two are added up. The awe, the reverence that she has, you see, for someone starved of attention, you know, that could then take crazy forms of what it might be.
Yeah.
In her head. So, I mean,
We go back to the third page when he's going to the to pay his bill at the telephone company, and he walks past several high school girls pricing cheap jewellery. They leaned on the counters in provocative poses, and Covenant's throat tightened involuntarily. He found himself resenting the hips and breasts of the girls, curves for other men's caresses, not his. He was impotent.
Right, yeah, the impotence. Yeah,
so imagine what that must be like, still having desires, but knowing that you'll never be able to satisfy them, and then becoming resentful I can understand. I mean, obviously I'm not that way myself, but it's, I think that section there in chapter one, in page three of chapter one, right at the beginning, it gives us an idea of how painful sexual impotence must be and how frustrating and...
But, sure.
I mean,
sure.
I'm not, of course I'm not, condoning or, you know, any of that.
But I mean, yeah, right. But I mean, if one, I mean, just to look at the other side of the possible experience of one's desires and not being able to do anything about that, and that is to potentially deal with them in the way that many monks, nuns, and things like that have dealt with, right?
Yeah.
I mean, effectively to transform it into something else.
Yeah. And perhaps that's what he was doing up until he was transported to the land, where he was just going through the survival rituals. And he was, it was becoming anger and discipline.
Mm. Who knows? But then, I mean, if you think about it, maybe those girls were the first, as it were, attractive and, you know, just cannot be had beyond kind of stimulus that he had had in the other world. Yeah. And he certainly reacted to it. So, yeah, I don't know that he'd dealt with it at all.
No, probably not. Perhaps he just avoided any situations.
Exactly. I mean, and yeah, who would anyway sleep with a leper?
Yeah, yeah. Because it does say there, even the release of lust was denied to him. He could conjure up desires until insanity threatened, but he could do nothing about them.
Yeah, so, anyway, so here he's then, right, feeling that things are changing, that, you know, even the impotence can potentially be healed, and then there are so many other kind of big things going about his what is maybe being expected of him. He wants to get away. She's there with him. He has another impulse to hit her.
Yeah. He does hit her.
And then he does hit
her.
Yeah,
he does.
When, isn't that at the point where he says... that he's living through a nightmare and this place is a nightmare, and she says, no, it's not. It's not a nightmare.
Yeah, he says to her, are you trying to drive me crazy? Lena flared with sudden courage. I do not believe it. It may be that your world, but the land, the land is real.
Right.
And that's when he reacts. Yeah, you're right. He says, this is a nightmare. And she says, no, it's real.
Yeah, and then Thomas, then Covenant whirled and struck her a stinging slap across the face. Like, just, you know, after saying, are you trying to drive me crazy? And after, and then, you know, she gets startled by the tone, and then he goes to the next level and slaps her.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's a difficult scene. I've actually not really been looking forward to talking about this, but it's a scene in the book that I know I've seen many people put the book down after this chapter, which, you know, I can understand.
His face contorted in a wild grin.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. She felt... that he was going to kill her.
Yeah, that's what it says. And she stood dumb and helpless.
She's also innocent, so, I mean, you know, she wouldn't even... It wouldn't even occur to her, maybe, that he was trying to rape her if she hadn't been looking at him, you know, and wasn't even maybe aware of the eyes that he was looking at her with on occasion.
Well, no, it's like we discussed last week with the idea of raising a stick to a dog.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
You know, and so, you know, as you've said, there's no indication that she's leading him on in any way. And he's seeing all these signals. And that's being explained to us at different parts of the story.
So, I mean, yeah, there's nothing else to it. He rips her clothes off and he rapes her.
Yeah.
And she doesn't resist. She feels helpless. Her limbs can't move. And this. But even as she cried out, she knew that it was too late for her.
Yeah.
Something that her people thought of as a gift had been torn from her.
Yeah. It's brutal.
Brutal. And he didn't feel like a taker. I mean. So, yeah. Yeah, so he. Yeah. So what is going on?
Yeah, I've got trouble talking about it, actually. I'm not finding this very easy.
Okay, it's so like, I'll give you, yeah.
You've right. got another 9 + 3/4 of a book left with this guy. You know what I mean? And that's why people put the book down. It's like...
I don't want to stick around with this guy's a hero.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. But knowing what I know, I can't really say anything, so I'll just leave it there.
But. Yeah. But, I mean, at the very least, it must make his own task all the harder. I mean, there's a side of him that has sensitivity, and once he comes back to a different level of awareness that is above the state that he's in when he rapes her,
yeah.
Then, I mean, you know, I mean, I did have the sense that this, for the first time, he acts diseased, in a diseased way.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I mean, there's no two ways to it in my sense. At the moment, from here, I can't imagine, I can't picture anything he might do, any movement of the storyline that could justify it.
No.
Or that could negate it, in a sense.
There's no redemption.
And I'm not being, yeah. right, exactly, exactly.
It's irredeemable, I mean, yeah.
In a sense, the violation, what was taken away from her, can never be returned.
Yes, absolutely.
And that beautiful innocence of self that was so beautifully expressed. I mean, yeah, who knows how that. So that, the cracking of that, I mean, her father can't fix it like he did the cup.
No.
And so, I mean, that was the real shocker, like, you know. And as you say, so early on.
I know.
Like, so early on, and there's already this much, like, set up, this massive a mountain to climb, and now it's, like, exponentially bigger, I think.
Well, it's not the story that you thought you were going into. It all changes. Mm-hmm. And I think the author must have... I mean, obviously he knew that this was coming. He must have wondered how much time to put in before it happened and decided not much.
Well, you know, yeah, right. And if this is, as it were, one of those doorways, yeah, I mean, I'm walking through because, I mean, this is part of the story, right? And, I mean, it's not a question of taking a moral position, because the position is self-evident.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, they just have to talk about what was there as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. This is why in the first episode we discussed, or at least I brought up the idea of Nietzsche and immorality, and whether if one were to act outside of the bounds of morality, inside a dream, if one did not believe that one's situation were real, then maybe he felt he could get away with it because there are no consequences.
I think that's an aspect, definitely an aspect, because it was the whole is this a dream or a nightmare thing that triggered the slap, and then, you know, and he also had the thought earlier on that, well, you know, I've got to push forward. He says something interesting, which I don't know, I thought might kind of mean something to you too. Madness was the only danger. He says that on page 72 in my thing on the previous chapter. He says his fingers twitched with violence, but he drew cool air deep into his lungs, put everything behind him. He knew how to survive a dream. Madness was the only danger. So, yeah. Yeah. And so, for me, this step of allowing his lust to embody this violation of Lena is a very big leap towards madness. Because I mean, even in the dream, I mean, I don't really think there's a difference. I mean, and after all, one cannot unequivocally say when one is in the dream state that this waking state is not the dream and the other way around. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, in a dream, perhaps that could be a lesson being taught. Mm. But, yeah, perhaps. I mean, you know, there's that. That does add an interesting dimension to it, you know. Then if it was a dream, what is it less of a thing that he raped Lena?
Mm. Yeah, I know. I mean,
right.
Does that absolve him of responsibility, yeah, as it would do if he were mad? In a sense, in a legal sense, perhaps.
Yeah, but then that's, I think that's a load of anyway, because, I mean, you know, law is technical.
All right, in a moral sense then.
Yeah.
But it certainly, it colours the rest of the story, as you would expect. And it's whether you have the desire to continue with it after this moment or not.
Oh, in general, you mean?
Mm.
Whether one has... I mean, I'm up for it. It doesn't... I mean, now that we've talked about it, you know, I was also not looking forward particularly to talking about it and, like, how are we going to tackle it and things. And I mean, I gave it a few thoughts and then just, you know, I think we've done a decent enough job.
I hope so. Yeah, I hope so.
You know? The consequences. I mean, I was thinking then, yeah, how is he going to show his face to his hosts? Like, you know?
I know.
And, like, how's that going to poison his endeavours to kind of be the hero? And like, yeah. And, like, poor wee Lena, what's going to kind of become of her like now, you know? Yeah, because... You know, that is that happy, carefree, innocent nature. Like, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, Stephen Donaldson seems to be dealing with all these subjects with a lot of subtlety. So it'll be interesting to see how it all develops and how it all kind of fits together and, you know, what the ties of cause and effect,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
whether dream or real, and you know the back and forth and all that, how that develops. So, yeah, I mean, I was shocked, but I'm not put off.
Good. I'm kind of glad that it's passed now because I've been. I mean, obviously, it looms large when you know it's coming, and it's like, I just want this out of the way so we can get on with the story.
Yeah, right, right. And,
you know, now that, I mean, we know that this is going to have consequences that are going to reverberate throughout the rest of it.
And I remember you telling me right at the very start when we were just even talking about this podcast, you were saying that there's a point and you'll know when it comes.
Yes.
And I knew when it came.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And I had some kind of inkling, well, maybe, I don't know, you know, if something happens between them, then, you know, that kind of, like, shady grey area of underage liaison things. But no, this is, like, a smash.
Yeah.
Like, smash.
So, yeah, you mentioned subtlety on the part of the author right up until the juggernaut hits you.
Duo. Right, right, right. But, yeah, I guess that's, yeah. But, I mean, it's certainly skilled writing, I have to say. Like, really enjoying the flow and use of language and the descriptions.
Good, good. Right, so we're moving on to Chapter 8 for the next time, which is 92, 102. That's 22 pages. And then Chapter 9, Jahannam, takes us up to 141. So you're up for reading 40 pages? 93, 03,
13, 23,
33. Almost 50 pages.
Oh.
Or do you want to just do a chapter?
Just do a chapter.
Okay.
Jahannam, is that not the Arabic word for heaven?
there are characters coming up that... we'll be able to discuss that I probably wouldn't have been able to discuss with anyone else.
Okay, cool. Let's just do one then, okay, and see how we tackle along. Cool, man.
Excellent.
Cool.
Okay. Well, folks, sorry for the heavy one. If you've stuck with us, thank you. We've got nowhere yet that you can send us your feedback. By the time this goes out, we will have, but...
we will have.
As we record, we haven't, so I can't ask for your feedback just yet.
But would love to hear it.
Yeah, we certainly would. So by the time this is up and running, we'll have links in the show notes, so you will know where to go to give us feedback, even though we don't right now. So you can do that if you feel a burning desire. We'll see you for the next one.
Thank you. Bye, folks.
See you later. Outcast Unclean. This is Future Cams here. I've just finished the edit. It's quite hard to listen to, so I just thought I'd come in and just ask if you're okay. I hope you're all doing okay after listening to that. Don't know if I am, actually. It was more difficult than I expected it to be, and I did expect it to be difficult to talk about that chapter and how it ended. So, yeah, it's not a fun one, but it does, now that that's over with, then we can move forward with the story. And of course, there will be consequences for what happened. How could there not be? I won't go into that here, obviously, but if you've stuck with me, then, you know, I thank you. It is worth sticking with. It's, you know, we wouldn't be doing a podcast about these books if they were not worthy of our time. And they would not be my favourite series of fantasy books were they not worthy, you know. It's just that one scene which, I mean, when I first read that, I would have been maybe 18, 17, 18, 19. Don't remember exactly when, but round about that age. And I don't know, maybe at that age it was easier, or maybe the time that we lived in, I don't know. But I got past it and I got through the books. And I just wanted to let you know how I'm feeling after doing that edit. At the end of the show we did talk about how we had nowhere to post, etc. Well, I said I would post some links. I can put in that information now because I've set it up. we now have a URL, which is theunbelievers.co, and we will be posting on Podbean. We'll be using the Podbean hosting platform. I believe if you download the Podbean app, if you're using iPhone or Android, I think, and I should check that, I don't know actually, I think you might get some more features if you listen to a Podbean hosted podcast using the Podbean app. Not sure, but I think so. We would love your feedback, and I know this was a heavy episode, so if you want to get in touch, and I mean, hopefully we've dealt with it in a sensitive way, you know, and I'm aware that we're two men talking about a rape scene written by a man, so, you know, I'm aware of that fact and how that might come across, but I am who I am, so I can only talk from my own experience and morals and values, so I hope it hasn't offended anyone. And if it has, I apologise. But I didn't write the book. I'm just here talking about it and putting out some content. So anyway, back to the hosting thing. Yep, theunbelievers.co. We will have a Patreon up and running. So if you would like to support the show financially, that would be amazing. Obviously, we've got a lot of costs at the moment to set all of this up. So if you'd like to contribute, that would help us out a great deal. So you'll find that over at patreon.com/theunbelievers. And if you'd like to show your support in a less tangible way, but an equally important way, if you were to go to your podcast host and give us a rating, 5-star rating obviously would be the best to get the podcast moving up the charts and into people's attention. And also, if you were able to leave a short review, that would help us out a great deal, especially as it's a new podcast. We've only just launched, so we need all the help we can get from listeners. And if you feel so inclined, we would be very, very grateful. So thanks for listening to this, folks, and we will be back again with another episode next week. Oh, before you go, just another wee quick announcement. I should add this on. We've set up a read-along using the Storygraph app, which is an app we really love. It's a read-along tracking app that's run by a small independent team, and it's perfect for our needs. They have a read-along feature that allows you to set up forums where you can have discussions, and all you need to do is sign up to the Storygraph for free, create an account there, and then you can join the read-along. I'll put a link in the show notes, and you can click that and head on over there and help us to support a small independent app. Thanks a lot. See you there.